From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in Radio West, the cultural history at the heart of America's opioid epidemic. The journalist Sam Quinones is joining us to trace the path of black tar heroin. It begins in one small county on Mexico's west coast. These are people driven to work their way out of poverty and humiliation who have developed a system for dealing dope that isn't unlike delivering pizza.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So there are two tales to the story of America's opiate epidemic. It's a scourge that is ravaging small rural communities and mid-sized cities and suburbs throughout the country. Utah's played a surprising role in this story. Now, the first part is the pain part, the opioid part. Last year, we had the journalist Sam Quinones on the program to take us through that part, how these highly addictive painkillers were developed and then got out of hand, leaving millions and millions desperately addicted. The other tale is about black tar heroin, that right around the late 80s, early 90s, it started flooding into the country. Now, Quinones was fascinated by this. He says it contradicted everything he knew about drug trafficking. The drug dealers stayed out of big cities. They worked in small markets like Boise and Salt Lake. They weren't violent. They developed a system, in fact, that worked like delivering pizza. That's the part of the story we're going to be talking about today with Sam Quinones. He's a journalist, former reporter for the LA Times. He's the author of three books. His latest is called Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. He joined us from a studio in Los Angeles. Explain what it was you knew about heroin when you first really started looking into this. Because you say you had that image of like the French Connection, that everything was in New York City and it was international. Let's start there, if you could, your sense of it before you started digging in.
Well, I'd grown up in the 70s. I watched those French Connection movies and Serpico, Prince of the City, these great heroin movies out in New York City. So early on in my life, that's what I thought about heroin, white powder coming through New York, that kind of thing, pretty much an urban drug. I then worked in Stockton, California as a crime reporter. And out there, I saw that the heroin was very different. First of all, there was no white powder at all. It was all black tar heroin that was coming up from Mexico. In this hemisphere, black tar heroin is only made in Mexico. Black tar heroin is a sticky kind of Tootsie Roll looking like substance, smells fairly acrid, like vinegar kind of, very cheap to make. It's not processed like the white powder, which has been purified and processed, taking all the impurities. Black tar is very cheap stuff. It's every bit heroin, very powerful, as powerful as white powder. It just hasn't been distilled to the degree that white powder has. And it's only coming from Mexico. And in fact, what I learned back then and for many years after that was that black tar heroin really never crossed the Mississippi River. It was really a Western United States drug. You found it in Denver and Portland and Seattle and Phoenix, of course, all over Los Angeles and the Central Valley of California, that kind of thing. But you never found it in the Eastern states. And I just thought that was gospel. There's many DEA reports where you can read from the 90s and so on that say that this is a drug that really hasn't crossed in any sustainable quantities across the Mississippi River.
And of course, your reporting led you to, among other places, Huntington, West Virginia. You were a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and you learned about the black tar outbreak there. This has been 10 years ago now, if I'm not mistaken, when you went to Huntington.
Correct. And I was stunned by that. That is really what got me onto this story. First of all, the movies that I'd seen in no way involved West Virginia. West Virginia was not a heroin state as far as I knew.
Right.
I'm reading these stories of all these people dying in this one town. In a six-month period, I think a dozen people died of overdoses. And that was the other thing. They were overdoses to black tar heroin. And I was thinking, no, this violates everything I've known. Black tar heroin is a Western United States drug. When did it hop the Mississippi River in quantities large enough to kill people in a state like West Virginia? And why does West Virginia have any appetite for heroin at all? None of this made any sense in my experience as a crime reporter. Yeah. And so I called Huntington PD. All this happened in the fall of 07.
Yeah.
And I was calling in 09 going, why did you guys have heroin outbreak of black tar in 07? And they were saying, well, all of that heroin, you have to call the DEA in Columbus, all of that heroin came from Columbus. Our addicts were driving up there, buying it cheap, taking it back, and selling it here, and a lot of people died because of that. And so that kind of led me to basically begin a research into how this whole thing could have happened to this one town.
You talked to this this man named Dennis Chavez. This moment almost seems like it was in a movie. Because one of Dennis Chavez's informants told him this one day, and you quote this in the book, referring to where this black tar heroin is coming from. He says, you know they're all from the same town, right?
Yeah.
It seems like such a dramatic moment. And was this the first time it started to occur to people? This is coming from one place.
Right. I think I was very well positioned to hear that. Because I had lived in Mexico for 10 years. I'd written two books about Mexico. I'd covered immigration a lot. And when you cover immigration, you begin to realize that all across Mexico are many, many, many hundreds of villages where everybody ends up doing the same job. And the reason is that people in Mexico, working class, poor people, do not have access to education that will transform them from being, say, a poor ranchero or peasant farmer into a lawyer or a mechanical engineer or a doctor. That just does not exist. So the way you find your life's work is from those around you. So one guy is a construction worker in Dallas. Pretty soon, everybody in the village is a construction worker in Dallas. And so when he said, the guy in Columbus said, you know, the strange thing is they're all from the same town. I knew that was possible. I knew, in fact, that was likely. That drug trafficking, like immigration, like a lot of things, economic things in Mexico, functions on the level of the village. This guy in Columbus told me of a business model for heroin, very much like pizza delivery. So guys would come here to in a part of a crew. They would drive around town with little balloons of tenth of a gram doses of black tar heroin in their mouths, 20, 25 balloons at a time, big jug of water so they could swig it down if the cops stopped, and never used guns. And it was very much like pizza delivery in that the addicts would call a number. Each crew had an operator. The operator would then dispatch a driver to wherever the addict was, a Target parking lot or where it would happen to be. And they would make essentially an international retail drug deal there.
Yeah.
And this system that they were seeing in Columbus and beginning in 98 and through the 2000s had been really perfected west of in the western United States. These guys had started in San Fernando Valley. And because they were all from the same town, they competed with each other. Everybody would say, oh, so-and-so's doing good business up there in San Fernando Valley. Pretty soon more crews would come up and they would start. Everyone would kind of learn from each other, but they couldn't kill each other because they were all from the same town. They knew where each other's mothers lived. It was not that kind of business. And so they expanded. Instead of killing each other over market share, which is what a lot of gangs have done, drug gangs have done, they expanded. They moved to other towns. They moved to San Diego, to Pomona, to Portland, and eventually they moved to Salt Lake, right about 1995 or so, something like that. Salt Lake becomes a big hub for them, as does Boise, Denver, Portland, Reno, Seattle, et cetera, et cetera. There's a bunch of these places. And then in 1998, because of this kind of capitalist expansion tendency that's very common to all franchises or all kind of capitalist entities, no different from these guys, they move across the Mississippi River. And that's the first time black tar heroin from Mexico moves across the Mississippi River in sustained, large quantities. And it ends up landing in Columbus, Ohio. The one guy, in fact, I interviewed him extensively in the book, brings it east of the Mississippi River for the first time to Columbus, Ohio in the summer of 1998.
Sam, I want to back up and talk a little bit more about these ranchos, these villages, because you describe your kind of affection for these places, this romantic infatuation, kind of lawless, wild places full of great stories. And you say that the people in these ranchos, the rancheros, embodied Mexico's best pioneering impulse. Explain what you mean by that and explain what these towns were like.
The rancho in Mexican culture is extraordinarily important. First of all, it's where all the great cultural creations of Mexico come from. Tequila, the great food from Mexico, mariachi music, norteño music. The rancho is usually, it starts as one person's ranch, but in time, as people marry, Seattle has lots of kids, people marry, it really develops into what is really a small village. What makes it different is it's on the outskirts. It's right. Not part of the political structure of Mexico, particularly as the 20th century gets going and Mexico develops a one-party state that is all about co-opting and bringing under the big tent all the actors, the political actors. The rancho is always on the outskirts. It's a very it's people looking to get away from the suffocating embrace of the lawyers and the politicians and of the bankers and all this. And so you get this kind of bred into people who live in the rancho, a very, very independent streak. Mm. Extraordinarily hardworking. Very hardworking. Everyone wants to be their own boss. They also have a lot of ideas that we might find backwards. They're very much against educating women and girls, for example. It's a very macho culture because it's families out on the edge of civilization who have to fend for themselves. There's no ambulances, no courts, no police that are going to kind of resolve problems for you. It's you against the very forbidding world. And rancheros are most common in about six or eight states in Mexico. Those six or eight states were the first ones to send immigrants to the United States: Michoacán, Jalisco, Guanajuato, Zacatecas, Durango, various places like that, Sinaloa. And so folks who came here and continue to come for many years were rancheros, most of them. And they had this very ingrained sense of daring, willing to risk all kinds of danger to move forward. And so we were populated, really, by Mexican rancheros. They look like Mexicans to everybody, but really, if you dig down deep, you'll find that most folks who came here were from the rancho in Mexico, which makes the rancho in Mexico one of the most important foreign institutions in American life today, because everywhere you go, you see these attitudes, very hardworking, very machista kind of culture. These folks also, a lot of them were immigrants who came and worked restaurants and construction. A lot of them started their own businesses, mom and pop markets, contracting businesses, a variety of things like that. There was that sense of, I want to be my own boss. I definitely don't want to work for somebody else. But this is also where the Mexican drug trafficking started. Yeah.
There's this cultural dimension that you write about. I wanted to also envidia and envy or jealousy.
Yeah.
Talk about that, because it seems like that is kind of this destructive force in a rancho.
That's huge. That's just absolutely fundamental. And I think anybody you talk to about life in these small towns, envidia or envy or jealousy is huge, a part of it. And that, you know, there's an intense social competition that begins as more and more rancheros migrate to the United States. They begin building houses. They begin returning home. It was easier to cross back and forth back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, say. And so there's a big culture of returning back home, showing what you have, coming home with nice cars, with nice dresses for the wives, big parties, marriages, weddings take place, big quinceañeras, big barbecues, paying for the beer all night. You know, you want to show that you went north poor and you're coming back really well to do. And as part of that, though, there's a lot of envy. People envying within families. Whole families have been destroyed over this. And it's that envidia that really propels people people forward. Everybody else has something. I want mine. I'm going to go north. It's definitely part of the drug trafficking impulse as well, to say, I want more than anybody, or the few people are starting to traffic drugs. I want what they have. And that pushes people to immigrate. To work in legal professions here in the United States. It also is a big motivating factor in how people get into drug trafficking, because drug trafficking is simply the rewards and the risks of immigration times 10, much more powerful the allure and much more powerful the risk.
You've talked about how this is a system born by these immigrants' desire to move ahead, but not move ahead in the United States, that they see the United States not as being home. They want to go back. So they
right.
live modestly here. So when they go home, they can really spend their money and show off.
Really, the impulse out of Mexico has never been to come and become an American. It's to come, make your money, go back home, which is very easy to do, very cheap, very quick, and show the others who you believe ran you out as a poor, shoeless kid what you were capable of, how much they lost when they lost you. And I have never found any Mexican immigrants who came here wanting to be an American. That does happen. It happens over, it's a long process over years, and finally, you know, they can't go home again. There's nothing for them back home. The village is empty. You know, the corruption is suffocating. The crime is bad. Whatever it happens to be, they decide to stay here and become an American. But that is not the impulse that drives them. It's more an impulse to want to show people back home how you did. You go to a high school reunion in America, it's the same thing.
That's Sam Quiñones. His latest book is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
On the next More to Say, it's hard to keep teachers in Utah's Monument Valley. It's beautiful there, sure, but you're hours away from a real grocery store or the movie theater. Now, though, there's a program to keep teachers invested in the community, and it's actually really simple. Pay them more. Jody Lee Chatty teaches fourth grade, and they're paying her $70,000 to do it. Go to KUER.org to see the new Radio West film about the story, and download More to Say, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling the cultural history at the heart of America's opioid epidemic. Our guest is Sam Quiñones. He's the author of the book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. You begin your book Dreamland with the story of Enrique. It's the name he went by, this young man who had grown up, as you describe it, in a hovel on the outskirts of a village. His father was a sugarcane farmer. And it's really interesting. You say growing up in a poor Mexican village had attuned Enrique to the fact that the world is not fair. And it seems like a kind of sad lesson that honest work just gets you treated crappy. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because this is another one of these cultural elements that plays into that bigger story.
I think in Mexico that people on the lower end of the economic spectrum realize that instinctively, that, you know, people get rich in Mexico by not playing by the rules. So there's this feeling like whatever you do, abiding by the law is a fool's game. Now, a lot of people still do it because the risks are greater than they want to run. But a lot of people turn to drug trafficking because they believe that there's no fair shake for them. Also, you should understand that part of being poor in Mexico is not just that you don't have any money. It's that you are humiliated by those just a few rungs up the ladder from you who once were poor themselves. They frequently, there's this intense feeling of laughing at people who are poor, belittling people who are poor, speaking sharply to women who have to come into the shops to buy bread or meat or whatever, or groceries. And escape, immigration, drug trafficking, all of that is profoundly connected to want to get out of a state of being humiliated all the time. And I think that's what drove Enrique, that you referred to in my book. He was a guy who just deeply, deeply wanted to never be humiliated again, to be on the plaza buying beer for all his newfound so-called friends, for all the girls who would talk with him, that he could buy land and build a house, the kind of house his father could never afford to build. All of that happened for him through selling heroin.
I wanted you to come back to something you were mentioning earlier, because I really want to dig into this. Let's talk about this system that they've learned, a system you explained for selling heroin retail, basically. You say it's kind of the same principle as a fast food joint. You use cheap, illegal labor,
yeah,
and it's kind of like pizza delivery. Would you just take us through how this works?
Well, yes, it developed over a period of years. As these guys just kind of figured this stuff out. The system developed also with technology. At first, it was pay phones and beepers. Later became cell phones, of course, and was revolutionized. But the system works basically like pizza delivery. You're an addict. You call a number that has been circulated, that you've been given. You find it a variety of ways. You find this phone number. And they take your order. They dispatch a driver. The driver, he's a kid. Normally, he's like a baker, a construction worker back in Mexico, an avocado farmer, a sugarcane farmer. These are jobs that go nowhere. You're not going to progress at all with those kinds of jobs. And he sees driving heroin as a better job for him.
So there's one thing you say about drivers, and I have to ask you about this. This is how you describe the drivers. You say their job is to drive the city with their mouths full of little uninflated balloons of black tar heroin, 25 or 30 at a time in one mouth.
Right. Yeah. They one guy showed me how that was possible. I could not believe it, but he showed me how he could do that. And plus they have another 70 to 100 balloons stashed somewhere in the car in some fake carburetor or something like that. That's normally how they do it. And so whenever he needs to re-up, he sold all the balloons in his mouth. He just goes and park somewhere, gets the stash, and puts more balloons in his mouth. And basically, always waiting for the phone call from the dispatcher, who takes the call from the attic. And usually they meet in public areas that are well-trafficked, you know, again, a Target parking lot, Burger King, some thrift store, whatever it happens to be. They normally have a few places where they'll meet people. These guys were competing with each other. So in Salt Lake, eventually, there would be, I think, five or six crews, if I'm not mistaken. Denver had 8 or 9, I think. Portland also, same thing. These guys all knew each other. They would go out to lunch in the middle of the workday. They'd break for lunch and go out and have you know, Mexican food together. They were in a period, though, in the early 90s, when they were starting out, this intensely expansionary thing began to happen in their village with this system. They were going to towns where the number of addicts was static. It was not growing. And so in order to have a business, you actually had to steal your customers from guys you knew. And this created some tension, but it never led to violence because they were all from the same town. They knew each other. Sometimes they were cousins. Certainly they all knew where each other's mothers lived. And so there was none
right.
of – but what did make them, however, was magnificent marketers.
Yeah.
They were the best drug marketers I've ever encountered, and they would give away free dope in front of methadone clinics all the time. That's how you get new customers, basically. Go to a methadone clinic, give away the dope. You buy from me Monday through Saturday, I give you a free one on Sunday. I've heard of that. If you bring me 5 new customers, I give you 50 free balloons. They were always discounting, always giving away free dope. You get out of jail, here's some free dope for you because I don't want to lose you as a customer. Basically, they were very good. The more competition they had, the better they became at customer service. Calling the customer later, was the dope any good? Did the guy get there on time? No. Well, I'm going to send somebody else, and he'll give you 3 free balloons. Just stick with me. Stay with me. That kind of thing. And also branding. Just the same way that we know what's in a can of Pepsi Cola when we buy it. Addicts knew what was in a balloon of that one of those guys was going to sell them. It was going to be a tenth of a gram, not more, not less. It was going to be pretty good quality, could be especially high quality at times. And if it wasn't, there was a phone number, a customer service number, basically, that you could call to make sure that you got what you thought you were due.
Yeah. Here's another interesting aspect of this trade. You say these cells from Jalisco, for example, they never dealt with African Americans.
Yeah.
Why?
It goes back a long ways. The relationship between Mexican immigrants and Black Americans in the United States is a complicated one. First of all, in Mexico, long before there was immigration, Blacks were viewed as kind of inferior, or, you know, good for nothing but working hard, that kind of thing. However, as immigrants began to migrate to the United States, and particularly, I would say Los Angeles was crucial in all this, they found the cheapest housing they could find, and that was frequently in African-American neighborhoods. This was also at a time when the Black gangs were expanding, and they saw these immigrants as extraordinarily vulnerable, and they began to prey on them. And so every immigrant you talk to, you frequently get a sense for there's a deep sense of aggrievement that they have been bullied, extorted, humiliated. And in fact, a lot of street gangs, Latino street gangs in Los Angeles, I can think of Florencia, which is one of the largest around, really started as protection from the African-American gangs, where at that time were reaching their apogee, you know. So there's also a feeling like Mexicans work and Blacks are on welfare. But whatever the case, a lot of Mexicans come with those attitudes. They've heard these attitudes. They've experienced them themselves. In the drug world, that is even multiplied more so because a lot of young African-American gang bangers who were also in the drug trade were notorious for robbing people. So you get that as well as these longstanding feelings that dealing with Blacks is a real mistake. These guys always felt that, largely because a lot of the people who started the system initially insisted on it. They had bad experiences with Blacks, and they just insisted, no dealing with Blacks, don't sell to them, don't buy from them, nothing. Plus, white people are where the money is, and we just want to deal with them. And so that was kind of how the system developed.
Which brings us to something that you've been writing about lately. You've been writing for the New York Times. You've been writing things for Medium. When you traveled to the American heartland to talk about Dreamland, your book,
yeah,
you said you saw these places that were important areas of support for Donald Trump, like rural Michigan and southern Indiana and rural Kentucky and Ohio. And you said you started to see this connection between support for Donald Trump and opiate addiction.
Yes.
Explain that, would you?
I feel very strongly that I think he won the election because of opiate addiction. I was traveling those areas in the fall before the election. So August, September, October. I was in those areas. I was in Michigan. I was in Ohio. I was in Indiana, et cetera, West Virginia. And everywhere I'd go, I would see maybe a couple Clinton signs and rows of Donald Trump signs. It was remarkable. These were sparsely populated areas by and large. So I thought, well, okay, you know, he's going to win these areas, but can he really win an election based on this? And actually, now I believe they did. There's a few reasons why I believe that. First of all, he clobbered Clinton in big chunks of these regions. These were counties where in 4 years before, Mitt Romney had barely won some of these counties with 49% of the vote. He comes in and gets 65 minimum. In a lot of these counties, it's 70, 75, close to 80% of the vote. And I'm talking about a lot of these counties in Ohio, and basically in the reason this was important is he won swing states. The states that he had to win, he won largely, I think, because of vote in the area where there is the kind of the opiate beltway, if you like to think of it that way. I'm thinking North Carolina. What are those states? You remember North Carolina, mm-hmm. Ohio, of course, yeah. Michigan, Wisconsin, all of those, Pennsylvania, big one too. And if you go to those areas, what's interesting is that those areas actually on paper ought to be feeling very, very chipper about things. The Great Recession had driven their unemployment rates up to 17%, 15%, 17%, even 20%. By 2010, it was a really brutal. A lot of businesses closed, et cetera. By the time the election rolled around, those counties were down to unemployment rates of 5, 6, 7%. Huge improvement. You would think that these areas were just magnificently optimistic about the world, and on the contrary. Because of opiates, first of all, those statistics were really hiding a deeper reality, which is that a lot of people were too strung out to actually even look for work.
Yeah.
And that so the 5%, 6% was really not a good reflection of the reality on the ground in a lot of these areas. Plus, a very important thing had happened in the intervening 4 years, and that was everyone became aware of this problem now. It was everywhere, and opiates tend to bring with them a kind of a deep negativity, an inertia, a fatalism, a sense that nothing is going right. Doesn't mean that every family needs to have a pill or a heroin addict in the family. For everybody to feel like, gee, the quarterback is strung out, the pastor's daughter down the road is strung out. Now, here I'm fine, and my family, we're not having any problems, but all around me are kids who are stealing I got my battery stolen out of my car, we get a stool dislocated, it's copper ripped off at the school over across town. There was a feeling of kind of things falling apart, and in those areas where he won huge by 70-75%, those areas are characterized by this. They were deeply mired in opiate addiction. One opiate addict could create a feeling of unease that rippled throughout his family, his street. And you didn't have to have too many of those for the whole town to feel like, gee, things are really falling apart. Then kids begin to die. And so there was this feeling in areas that by the numbers you would think would have done very well under Obama. We're feeling like, no, actually, on the contrary, things are falling apart. We're dying here, and we need something very, very new. With opiates, it's so dire, so catastrophic, that you do look for easy answers. You look for anything, any life raft to pull you out of it. And I think Donald Trump, frankly, appealed to that.
You say our country's national opiate scourge is almost entirely white.
Yes.
You say that in 3 years of book research, you met one non-white person who was among the newly addicted to prescription pain pills.
Yes. And I have to tell you, I'm not entirely sure all the reasons why that is. I think I have answered for myself a lot of the questions I started out with when I began this project. That is one that I don't know if I have a full, complete answer to that, or a series of answers that all add up to a complete answer. But it's absolutely true that this is a problem that affects, I have to say, like 90% white people. There's never been a drug scourge that is so uniracial in the history of the country. Even crack, which I covered extensively as a young reporter when I was starting out in the town of Stockton, California. The dealers were black, but the users were of all races. I remember this very distinctly. Here, it's really all the users are white. There are some who are not. There's Native Americans who have been pretty severely hit by this. And occasionally, you'll see blacks or Latinos, a few Asians here and there. But by and large, it's really a major issue because it's killing more people than any drug scourge ever has. More this last year, perhaps, we're going to find out, more than the entire number of soldiers who died in Vietnam from the United States. But it's almost entirely white people. And why that is, I'm not quite sure. But people say, one thing that's important in all this, though, is to understand that people say, well, people are only paying attention to this because it's white people who are involved. And actually, the opposite is true. This problem has been going on for 20 years, and it's only recently in the last 2 years when it's got, in my opinion, the attention it deserves. And that's because it primarily has affected white people. It's been quiet because it's affected white people, not the reverse. And the reason that is that a lot of people who saw their kids get addicted first to pills and begin to die from that, and then later people who saw their kids get addicted to that.
Mm-hmm.
These are folks who are almost all white, and extraordinarily embarrassed by this fact that their kids could, their beautiful kids that they had, they were imagining when they were born this beautiful script. They're middle class kids, they're suburban kids. They were imagining this wonderful life script for these kids. Turns out they're in jail. They can't rent a house because they got a criminal record now. The parents are getting late night phone calls, collect phone calls from the jail, and then the child dies. Most of those parents did their utmost, did their very, very best to keep the true cause of death quiet. This was kept secret because people were embarrassed. It was the horrible, horrible stigma of addiction, and particularly addiction to opiates and, of course, heroin, was just overwhelming for a lot of people. So it's only in the last 2 years, if you ask me, that we've seen the kind of attention given to this that it's actually deserved, when really it's been festering as a problem for 20.
In the states that were crucial to Donald Trump's victory, mostly rural, as you say, religious, white, they're now heroin beltways. And you say this amounts to, as you put it, a stunning change in our national culture. Spend a moment with that. What do you mean by that?
When I started this project, I had to answer the question, seems to me, why is this a problem in Appalachia and in Rust Belt towns that have been beaten down by all the economic forces we know so well of globalization and downsizing? And why is it a problem there? And why is it also a problem in, say, Charlotte, North Carolina, or Salt Lake City, places that have done very, very well and have nice gleaming suburbs? Why is it kids out in those suburbs that have done better than almost any humans in the history of the planet? Why are those kids, too, turning to drugs used, of all things, to numb pain and getting addicted to them and dying? And to me, that was a major question, because the economic argument works in some areas, but it doesn't work as a national answer. You know, the people are, most of the places where this is a problem are in really well-to-do areas. Charlotte, North Carolina, banking center, two sports teams, beautiful skyline, mansions, country clubs, people dying all over and addicted to heroin. And the answer was that I felt, as I got into this book, was not that this had sometimes to do with economics. Mostly, though, it had to do with our own isolation. Yeah. We have become intensely isolated as a culture, and Americans all across the country. We have, meanwhile, spent at least, I would say, 35, 37 years, let's say, destroying community. And we have done that by allowing jobs to go overseas and not really helping the people who were mightily affected by it. We have done that by building suburbia that is intensely isolated and soulless and big and beautiful and wealthy, but not a place that where you feel like you know people. The internet has helped that enormously. I think social media, you get these kind of phony connections, phony connectivity when you lacking any real human soul. 24-hour news has been magnificent in isolating us. It just puts us all in little bubbles, red, blue, I believe this, you believe that, I'm not changing, everyone's shrieking at one another. There's many, many things in American culture that are serving to isolate us, and these drugs, the opiate class of drugs, are the most isolating of drugs. When you use these drugs, all you want to do is be alone in your little bubble. You don't want to know anybody who doesn't use dope. You want to hang out with people who use and sell and know where to buy. Those become your friends. So this is they really have become the poster class of drugs. If you the poster drugs for our extraordinary isolation as a culture, and this goes from coast to coast. This is a far more explanatory answer, I think, than people are having trouble economically. That's true in certain areas, certainly. It doesn't explain a lot of areas, though. And so to me, it feels like these are symptoms. These drugs are that they are nationwide, and they are affecting primarily white people who've done best, who haven't health insurance, who are in suburbs where people don't know one another. And this is kind of a better, a more explanatory, clearer answer, it would seem to me, that we have simply destroyed community. We have exalted the private. The private sector is viewed as this magnificent a generator of jobs, and we applaud people for making millions and billions of dollars, even though the way they made their money may have had actually a harmful effect on our communities. Meanwhile, we laugh at government. And we view government as wasteful and inefficient and bumbling. We exalt the private. We laugh at the public sphere. We don't let our kids go outside because, God forbid, you know, they skin their knees. We give them trophies for just showing up. There's this all this feeling of hyperprotectiveness along with isolation. I think it helps explain this. The interesting thing is that as I was doing this story, this is a story of the private sector inflicting the greatest drug scourge, not drug traffickers, not street dealers. This is done by pharmaceutical companies, as we talked in our last interview, doctors believing that they should prescribe these pharmaceutical-grade prescription pills over and over and over in massive quantities. And the only people I was finding in the middle of writing my book who were actually fighting this were government employees, were coroners and cops and prosecutors and public health nurses and ER docs and on and on and on, county drug counselors, et cetera. So in answer to your question, I'm not there, there's a lot. What I began to realize, though, is as I was writing this, is I thought I was writing a book about drug traffickers and drug trafficking. And really, it became a book about America and who we are and what we become.
You've been writing some amazing stuff for the New York Times. One of your recent pieces was from Covington, Kentucky, and how these jails and detention centers have become these kind of cheap drug treatment centers. And you say, in some ways, we could look at this as this amazing opportunity to rethink jail, is how you put it.
Oh, this is one of the great radical ideas, I think, and beautiful ideas, I think, that's come out of the opiate epidemic. You know, for years, decades, forever, we have treated jail one way, which is a place to park people for 6 months, 9 months as they wait trial or as they serve their DUI term or whatever it is. These jails are uniformly boring. They're also can be very violent, very predatory. There's some weird sexual stuff sometimes going on. There's a lot of trading and bartering and preying on others and all that kind of stuff. None of that is helpful towards an addict's recovery from drug addiction. And so, but keep in mind, the people we're putting in there, a large percentage of them are drug addicts. They have been, particularly if they're addicted to opiates, they've been on the street, basically slaves to opiate addiction. They have been living under the overpass. They've been stealing from their grandparents or their girlfriends. They've been just going from high to high, from dope to dope hit to dope hit. They get arrested for something. Usually it's a minor thing, possession of stolen property, say, something like that. They get put in jail, and there they detox. And for the first time, they are not, in months, they are thinking, they begin to think clearly. They've purged the drug from their system, and now they're thinking rationally. There's this moment of clarity for a lot of people once they detox, like, what have I done with my life? And it's at that very moment when historically, for decades now, we have been putting people in jails that are tedious, predatory, violent, weird, on and on, nothing. And so by the end of their 6 months, when they finally get out, if they get out, they go right back to using because it's so intensely stressful living in that environment. Now, what's happening in Kentucky, a few other places, Indiana's another place that's beginning to try this as well, is that they're turning these pods where these guys stay into full-time morning, noon, and night rehabilitation centers. So you're not losing that opportunity to grab the guy while he's thinking clearly and say, hey, there's a new way. It doesn't mean that everybody who goes through these things will see the light and hallelujah, they're cured or anything like that. This is a complicated thing, addiction, and it involves lots of relapse and involves a lot of very complicated problems. But it does seem to me a way of saying, this is a better way of using our taxpayers' money with higher chance of a positive outcome than what we already know has failed over and over all across the country. A lot of people don't like to hear that. A lot of people don't like to hear, well, we need to use jail. They want to say, no, we've used jail and jail's a bad place. Well, jail the way we used to run jail, yes. It is a bad place. It's a terrible thing. It's a catastrophic, in fact. But to suggest that addicts, while they're on the street, will opt for the rational choice of getting themselves into treatment, assuming they can even afford it, which is a huge assumption and very often not the case, it misunderstands, I think, the nature of these drugs. These drugs are the most enslaving drugs that we know as a human species. And to what usually ends up happening is that people, when allowed to stay too long on the street, they hit rock bottom. And with these drugs, rock bottom is very often death. So my feeling is that some of these jails in Kentucky, Indiana, a couple other states I think are trying them, are a way of rethinking jail. That this gives us this the opiate epidemic is calling on us to rethink jail. It's a fundamental piece of how we get out of this. In fact, is to rethink how we do jail. It's not more costly on the contrary, it frequently is cheaper to run a jail pod this way than the old way because there's fewer fights, it's cleaner, that kind of thing. Everywhere I go, I talk to people, give speeches in public in many, many places all over the country, they're always asking, what's the solution to this? And there is no solution. There's no one solution to this. There's many. And one of them, it seems to me, is to rethink how we've done jail up to now.
So Donald Trump has made a lot about wanting to build a wall at the Mexican border. You've been reporting about this. You say there's this belief that a wall could somehow stop the heroin from coming north. And you say, look, walls could stop people, but not really drugs. Explain why.
It's unlikely. I think it's highly unlikely. And the reason I say that is because people need to understand we have walls along the border. They are in the most populous areas. They're in Tijuana, San Diego, they're between Juarez, El Paso. They're very good. In fact, in Tijuana, which I know pretty well, there are two walls there. One that goes for 14 miles, begins in the ocean. Goes for 14 miles, stops at a big mountain. They didn't build it up the mountain because they figured the mountain was barrier enough. In other parts of the border, we have the Rio Grande, which is, a difficult swim for a lot of people and has acted as a barrier. People are already smuggling heroin through areas with lots of walls and well-fortified parts of the border. They just, the idea that you would build a wall and that this would stop drug trafficking assumes that people are somehow running the stuff across in the middle of the desert. That does happen on occasion, but in small quantities, really. It doesn't add up to our national appetite for heroin, that is for sure. Heroin is also very, very easy to smuggle. It is a drug that really owes its existence to smugglers and drug traffickers. There's no medical reason to have heroin around. It's high addictive risk and moderate pain killing attributes. The reason it exists is because of heroin drug traffickers. They found this drug to be easy to conceal, easy to make, easy to cut, and it creates customers that have to come to you 3, 4, 5 times a day. Unlike other opiates like methadone once a day and you're done, this is a constant thing. You have to buy this from your dealer every day, Christmas included. So it's really a drug created whose life is really owed to drug traffickers. From Mexico, people are finding it very easy to traffic small heroin in small quantities. So not the 50 kilos, 100 kilos, 200 kilos. That does happen from time to time, sure. But a lot of people are smuggling in 3 pounds, 5 pounds, 4 kilos here, 2 kilos there, because you can make a lot of money by smuggling very pure heroin into the United States, which is what they make in Mexico, very high potency heroin, which I talked to a DEA agent was saying, we're seeing in his town an 80, high 80, early, low 90% purity of the heroin. Unheard of. We've never seen that. But you can smuggle that kind of heroin into the United States, and you can smuggle it in boom boxes. I have a picture from the DEA I'm going to put up on Facebook at some time of a woman who strapped 3 kilos of heroin to her butt, and she just looks like she has a very large derriere. That's the way heroin is smuggled. And walls, building yet another wall in areas where people are already crossing border crossings with their dope or in cars or in trucks is not going to help anything. I think it's highly, let's put it this way, I think it's highly unlikely that will do anything for our heroin supply ever.
So you mentioned earlier it was the private sector really that introduced these problems, which is a kind of ironic twist for people who, you know, love the free market, don't trust the government, which addicts are relying on for now for treatment and financial relief.
Yes.
And I wonder, you say many of the areas where Donald Trump received support, they're going to need massive investments in drug treatment.
Yeah.
Is that going to happen? Is there going to be the political will and the government money to do that?
Well, I don't know. But that is a very good question we're going to have to see. I mean, I do believe kind of my terminology is we need a kind of a Marshall Plan for investment in treatment. We had a Marshall Plan for investment in prisons in the 80s and 90s. I was in California when that happened. And that had its reasons, and I don't think all of them were bad, honestly. But at the same time, we did not build up an equal capacity for treatment. And we really need a lot of those areas where that voted for him are areas that are hoping to be made great again. Well, those are areas where people, when jobs come available, 50-70% of the people who apply for them cannot pass a drug screen. Could be marijuana, could be heroin, could be opiates, whatever it is. There are a lot of people in those areas that cannot pass a drug screen. It's very hard for me to see how you can find people willing to invest in large numbers, large amounts in those areas. When the workers all around them are strung out, and when a 5% unemployment rate looks great, but what it really hides is probably more like a 14% unemployment rate, because so many people are incapable of working, or if they can pass a drug screen to get the job, very quickly they go back to using. This is also part of the problem. The business people really need to take a look at this as a business issue, because it destroys productivity in whatever county or region you're from. Whether or not the current administration will see that and move forward on that, I could not begin to tell you. But it seems to me that that's the kind of approach that we need to think of. And also, we need to be patient. We need to take a long-term approach, because this is not going to be solved in a year or 2 years. It seems to me that this is a problem that's going to be with us for quite some time.
That's Sam Quiñones. His latest book is called Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. He joined us from a studio in Los Angeles. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Adrian Moranville. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.